I have had, and interpret it for me if you can. Now, let's set up the context. This is Penelope. He's speaking to the disguised person who is really Odysseus, her long, long husband, whom she hasn't seen for 20 years. And the question is, what is Penelope really wanting from this stranger? Has she recognized the stranger already? Why is she asking the stranger to interpret a dream? And then she goes on to narrate her dream, that she has 20 geese. Well, what does 20 suggest to us? Odysseus has been away. One for each year that Odysseus has been away. So it's like saying, this will mean nothing to anybody else, but this will mean something very special to you if you're Odysseus, right? So it's already coding. And they eat mash out of the trough, and of which I'm exceedingly fond. Now, this can't be the suitors, right? Because she doesn't like the suitors, does she? She says she's fond of them. I dreamed that a great eagle came swooping down from a mountain and dug his curved beak into the neck of each of them till he killed them all. Presently he soared off into the sky and left them lying dead about the yard. Whereupon I wept in my room till all my maids gathered round me, so piteously was I grieving because the eagle had killed my geese. Then he came back again and, perching on a projecting rafter, spoke to me with human voice. I just love this. This is the only time you'll ever see something like this in archaic Greek literature. I defy you to see another situation where an omen stops being an omen and says, well, actually, I signify such and such. It's a little bit like Monty Python. There's that sketch about the village idiot where the village idiot is making everybody laugh and making faces. And then the moment the village idiot thinks that the camera is looking only at him and there's nobody for him to be a village idiot to, he then starts explaining his social function in the society, you know. So anyway, here's the eagle saying, well, here's what I signify. But listen, this is still Penelope speaking in a context, right? And this is still Penelope speaking to somebody who hasn't identified himself, and somebody she may or may not know, I'm not telling you, she may or may not know that is her long-lost husband of 20 years ago. So here's what the talking eagle says. But remember, this is not the main narrative. This is a narrative within a narrative, and in fact, it's a quotation within that. Be of good courage, daughter of Ikarios. This is no dream, but a vision of good omen that shall surely come to pass. The geese are the suitors. It's just the kind of thing you want, you know, when you want a sort of a monarch notes explanation of something. This is a monarch notes explanation. The geese are the suitors. And I'm no longer an eagle. Well, why not? Because he's talking, right? I'm no longer an eagle, but your own husband, who am come back to you and who will bring these suitors to a disgraceful end. Now you're saying to yourself, but he is speaking this truth because I know, I've read the whole Odyssey. This is just like all the very good essays I got where, remember Achilles is saying in Iliad, scroll 9, line 413, I have a choice between Nostos and Kleos. And some of you pointed out to me, well look, he hasn't made up his mind at that specific moment. You only know that Achilles makes the choice of Kleos, eternal glory by way of the Iliad, versus Nostos, which would not work for him, when you read the whole Iliad, right? You don't know it at that precise moment, and maybe he doesn't know it at that precise moment. You see how my close reading today, it is almost like an Ainos, remember that word, A-I-N-O-S, a coded message with a surface meaning and an underneath the surface meaning. It's really an Ainos for the whole course, isn't it? Where at any given moment that you're reading something, it may mean one thing in that context, but when you see the overall context, you realize what the deeper meaning is. Isn't it also an Ainos for the concept of the hero? Everything we've learned about so far, which is that the hero is dynamic, not static. At any given freeze frame where you see a hero, And what the hero is doing, you can't say this is the hero because the hero is in motion. And you can't pin the hero down until what point? Death. I gave away the whole lecture. So, end of quote. And again, you can say, well, this is exactly what will happen in the Odyssey, so this is true. I say it's true, but it's still the surface truth. And why does the Odyssey go to such length and going on for quite a few more verses? And why all the elaborations and the embroideries, if that's all there is to it? Well, let me not answer my question prematurely. Let's go on. On this I woke. So then she wakes up. Now it's her reality, right? So now she can sort of interpret for herself what this dream means. And she is asking the stranger to interpret the dream for her. Now, you could always say, did she really have this dream, or did she make it up? You could say so many things, and we'll get to questions like that in a minute. But let's go on. On this I awoke, and when I looked out, I saw my geese at the trough eating their mash as usual. They're just going peck-peck. And it's as if nothing happened. They're still there. What was the purpose of crying uncontrollably and feeling so empathetic about them? And then Odysseus, the disguised Odysseus, and let's say she doesn't know yet who this person is, rises to the challenge and interprets. So she says, this dream, lady, replied Odysseus, can admit but of one interpretation. Well, if there's only one interpretation, then maybe we should stop reading. But let's go on. For had not Odysseus himself told you how it shall be fulfilled, the death of the suitors is portended, and not one single one of them will escape. Only one interpretation? Well, could I ask you a question, which is, many of you must have heard that song, I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face. It's like breathing out and breathing in, et cetera, et cetera. And, okay, so let me grant you that she doesn't like the suitors. She doesn't like these people who have been paying all this attention to her for 20 years. Okay? And then suddenly her husband comes back after 20 years, no explanation. Right? And then, okay, we're several steps removed from quote-unquote reality, but the husband says, I'm your husband, be happy. I just came back. There is that problem of the way Russian formalists describe it, defamiliarization, where it's been 20 years that she hasn't known him, and all she has is the memories of 20 years plus ago. Okay? And so in a sense, the geese are familiar to her. The eagle is suddenly strange to her and unfamiliar. That's not saying that she really prefers the geese to the eagle. I'm just saying that this is a beautiful way to explore a woman's emotions and how a woman would feel in this particular situation, which the disguised Odysseus confronts her with. So look at her answer. Wow, what an answer. Stranger, dreams are very curious and unaccountable things, and they do not by any means invariably come true. There are two gates through which these insubstantial fancies proceed. The one is of horn and the other ivory. Those that come through the gate of ivory are fatuous, in other words, vain, inconsequential, insubstantial. And those from the gate of horn mean something, look at this, mean something to those that see them. In other words, I know my meaning. It was my dream, but I still ask you to interpret it. And then it goes on, I do not think, however, that my own dream came through the gate of horn, though I and my son should be most thankful if it proves to have done so. Okay, a little bit of word game. In ancient Greek, the word for ivory is very related to a word that would mean, it's not related, but it sounds like a word that would mean to get things wrong, to be deceived, to have your mind scrambled. So that's something we wouldn't automatically know if we didn't know the ancient Greek language. That's why I'm telling you. So there's a kind of play on words in her associating ivory with false dreams. And then about true dreams, gate of horn, well, you know what that word sounds like in ancient Greek? It sounds like when you say something and it comes true. And we'll explore this kind of wording later, but the idea is you say something, you may not even intend the truth, but in the long run, the story proves that what you said was absolutely 100% true. To show you what a complex personality Penelope is, Horn in those days, as also I think in much of our own metaphorical world, is an aphrodisiac. And it's no accident that we still say today vulgarism, to be horny, that has to do with making metonymic contact with aphrodisiacs, with sex stimulants. And that's also part of what Penelope is saying. So curiously, the gate of Horn is also a gate of desires, of sexual desires. And that's all part of this beautiful, multi-level, rich description of a woman's feelings at, what is it, a crisis moment, a moment of crisis where you have to figure out how to interpret. Now, if you notice again, once again, that in archaic Greek poetics, in order to understand, in order to get it, you have to engage not just your mental powers, but also your moral and emotional powers. And you remember there was a special word for this, Ainos, A-I-N-O-S, if you talk about audio. There's another word for it if you talk about video, which is Sema, S-E-M-A. But in any case, throughout we're seeing that emotion, affetto, affection, is one of the three components. And that's what I'm emphasizing today, obviously. So for, Odysseus and Penelope to get it, they have to have the right emotional qualifications. They have to be the right people. They have to have the right ascending scale of affections. Because if the two of them are not at the very top of each other's ascending scales of affection, then the reading doesn't happen. The reading is scrambled, and we don't get it. The only way we can understand it is if we are willing to be emotionally predisposed to what a couple who have been separated for 20 years might feel like. Okay? And since we've talked so much about ascending scale of affection, let's look at Aristotle's definition and compare it with the Iliadic model of ascending scale of affection, which turns out to be an Odyssean model as well. What he's essentially saying here in footnote 2 is that you recognize somebody as you start knowing more and more and more about them until you reach a certain point of saturation where, bang, you recognize them. But that increasing knowledge has to be accompanied with an increasing amount of emotional closeness, affection. And it's measured in terms of philia, being philos, being near and dear. And that's why I've always translated it as near and dear, because the affection is built into the dear. The measuring is the near. But don't we even today say, I feel very close to somebody, and that's a metaphor for saying I'm near and dear to somebody, I'm philos to somebody. And because Aristotle is Aristotle, I love the way he hedges, and he says, well, it can go the other way. It's where suddenly you wake up one day and realize the person you really love, you don't love anymore, you hate them. And my favorite film example is in The Shining, if any of you ever saw that, where the Shelley Duvall figure finally realizes that her husband is a monster. And it's quite a moment when that recognition scene happens. Now, for us, when we're thinking of drama, we're thinking of epic, recognition is recognition. But what's beautiful for this song culture is that this same word, in a slightly different form, also means I read. In other words, when in this culture you're exposed to something like epic or tragedy, and you have to understand it, what you're going through is a recognition seen of its own. And in other words, the reader has to have his or her own recognition at key moments. And if you don't have that, you fail. And that's why I keep harping that you can't be consumerist about this kind of medium, because it's not what it'll give to you as a product, it's how it engages you and how it helps you understand yourself. And I say helps you understand yourself because look at exactly what I'm footnoting with footnote 2. Footnote 2 goes back to focus passage D, where Odysseus is traveling from one place to another, and he came to know the mind of many people. But the ancient Greek leaves it ambiguous whether it's just the minds of the people he made contact with or whether it's also his own mind. And I suggest to you that the whole Odyssey, as we revisit the initial verses of the Odyssey one more time, is not only about how to discover how other people think, but how to discover what you think, what you yourself think. And that affections, which is requirement number 3, and that a moral sensibility, requirement number 2, are just as important as just plain intellect, which is requirement number 1. So with that in mind, let's look at focus passage B, which is another pivotal moment in the plot of the Odyssey. I say pivotal moment, how would you say it in Greek? Where all your understanding hangs in the balance. Again, the key word for today, crisis. It's a crisis point. And when I say crisis, you understand that this is also the word that gives us critical, as in critical moment, but also the intellectual process where you criticize something, where you try to sort out the apples and oranges, where you try to separate the sheep from the goats, or the bigger apples from the smaller apples, whatever the point of crisis is. It's a process of separation, of winnowing out what is real and what is unreal. I deliberately put it in Penelope's way because we'll only understand this other very intricate Inos, focus passage B, if we understand Penelope's way of looking at things, not just Odysseus's way of looking at things, and it has to be emotional. So Odysseus is in the realm of the unconscious. Let me set it up for you. He meets the Psyche, the disembodied conveyor of identity, of the prophet, a seer, whose name is Tiresias. There he is in the first line of focus passage B. And why is he there? Because he wants the seer to have a vision about how he, Odysseus, will finally achieve his own homecoming. What's the word for that? Nostos. And I'm happy to tell you that if you look a little bit further ahead in this same passage, I couldn't include all of it, it turns out that Tiresias is a master of nous, which is the kind of mind that enables one to see what one's nostos, return to home and return to basic identity, really is. So there's the usual sacrifice and pouring of blood, because as we'll see, it's blood that makes the consciousness of the dead get activated. It's like a recharging of the battery of consciousness. So for a few minutes of sacrificial blood, there's consciousness, and then Tiresias can speak, and he says, line 100 in the, "You want to know," said he, "about your return home." If you saw this in the original Greek, it's not an accident that nostos is the first word. It's like that's the number one thing to interpret, that's the number one key to the whole plot, that's what everything is about. So you're wondering about your nostos, are you? Your safe homecoming, or your song about a homecoming. Then he proceeds to tell him the whole Odyssey, the second half of the Odyssey. So this is like a fast forward of everything we're reading from scroll 11 all the way through scroll 24. But it's like the fast forward doesn't stop. The fast forward keeps going, and you say, wait, no, you stop here. This is where the Odyssey ends. No, this prophecy will go beyond what our Odyssey will cover. In other words, the prophecy just can't stop, and it'll say, well, after you killed the suitors, so there goes the giveaway of the plot, after you've killed the suitors, then you're going to go on the ultimate adventure. And once again, you have what we can call the Jungian concept of coincidence of opposites, because what he's supposed to do is take the or, which is the number one symbol of what he stands for, to take his oar as the ultimate sailor of Greek epic, and to start going inland, and preferably up, as far away from the sea as possible. So not only inland, but if it's possible, going uphill. And the way this coincidence of opposites is introduced, I've underlined. You see where Tiresias says, I will give you this certain token which cannot escape your notice. And then he tells them how he's supposed to do this. And he's supposed to keep going and keep pushing the frontiers of what is known until he reaches a point where people no longer recognize that that thing that he's carrying on his shoulder is not an oar. I had too many negatives there. Where people do not recognize that thing that he's carrying as an oar, and think that it's a winnowing shovel. Now, I bet you want to know what a winnowing shovel is. Winnowing shovel is what you do when you're harvesting wheat, let's say. And can you imagine all the harvested wheat with the whole harvested material in a big pile? What you're supposed to do is take the winnowing shovel and toss it up in the air, and then even the slightest breeze will blow the chaff off to the side, and the genuine article, if I can call it that, the real grain, will fall back down straight. And you keep doing this. It's very laborious until you've winnowed the grain from the chaff, until you've separated the real thing from the not real thing, the useless thing, which is the chaff. The chaff will be blown away by the wind, I should say blown aside, and what lands will be the real thing. And then, at that point, when Odysseus has done that, he's supposed to make a sacrifice. And couldn't you say that the sacrifice is made on a crisis point of interpretation? Because precisely at the moment that what he's carrying is no longer recognized as an oar, and is recognized instead as a winnowing shovel, that's the moment he's supposed to stop his journey and sacrifice to Poseidon, who was the god who was his ritual antagonist as a sailor. All right? And at that point, death will come to him. And the death is described as gentle, as sacred. And there's again that key word that we saw in the lecture that we had the last time, orbios. You remember how the psyche, the psyche of Agamemnon, called Odysseus Orbios, blessed. Not in the material sense, not in the surface sense that he's happy or lucky or fortunate, but that he's going to have some kind of heroic charisma that lasts beyond death and that, in fact, gives fertility after death. This is the second time I'm introducing this. The next time we meet, the third time, you'll see the historical fact of ancient Greek civilization, that these people worship heroes for their supernatural power of giving fertility after death. And that the mystical word, the word of initiation for why you worship heroes for this, is this word, orbios. And orbios, which will now translate in its mystical sense, its underneath the surface sense, as blessed. This meaning, blessed, is the key to the concept of the hero from the point of view of Greek religion, because the hero in death is a talisman of fertility for the community that worships the hero. This is history. This is the way people worship heroes. This is beyond the pure literature we're reading, but it's also the anchor and the real meaning of the literature. To show you that this tradition survives to this day, because ancient Greek song culture has lived on to be what is today the modern Greek song culture. I give you in C two variant tales, and then I threw in a third one about a character called Saint Elias, who is a transformation of the prophet Elijah in the Hebrew Bible. Let's read variant A. Saint Elias was a seaman who lived a dissolute life, but he repented of what he had done and thereby detested the sea. Or, because he had suffered much at sea and had often nearly drowned, he became disgusted with voyaging. Anyway, he resolved to go to a place where people know neither what the sea was nor what ships were. Putting his oar on his shoulder, he set out on land, asking everyone he met what he was carrying. So long as they answered that it was an oar, he proceeded to higher and higher ground. Finally, at the top of a mountain, he asked this question, and the people answered, "A stick." And, you know, this is definitely not a hero's reading, right? Understanding that they had never seen an oar, he remained there with them. Variant. The prophet Elias was a fisherman who, because of terrible weather and terrific storms, became afraid of the sea. So he put an oar on his shoulder and took to the hills. When he met a man, he asked him what it was he was carrying. The man answered, it was an oar, and Elias went on. The same happened when he met a second man, but at the top of the mountain, he asked a third man, who replied, "Why, that's a stick." Saint Elias resolved to stay there. Now, here's a very important part of the narrative, which variant one didn't have. He planted his oar in the ground, and that is why his chapels are all built on hilltops. And to this day, in Orthodox Christian practices in the Greek-speaking world, people on the 20th of July, which happens to be the climactic moment of harvest, especially wheat harvest, go on pilgrimages to the top of mountains where the shrines of Saint Elias are located. Now, of course, even in the Hebrew Bible, you can see a very good reason why in Christian traditions this theme should be associated with Saint Elias or the prophet Elijah. What happens in the Hebrew Bible to Elijah at the moment of his death? Now, come on. I know you're not responsible for this, but you should know this. I think I heard that a chariot of fire comes for him and spirits him away. It spirits him to the skies, okay? And this point of veneration, where essentially the veneration of a saint coincides with the celebration of harvest when people have winnowed their grain, shows you the religious foundation again and shows you exactly what it is to be obvious. Because you see, when you harvest, that's when all the efforts, all the punoi, all the labors of an everyday community come together beautifully, just as the hero's identity comes together beautifully at the moment of death. And then at that moment of death, you have the true sense of what it is to be blessed, what it is to be obvious. The hero is obvious because we worship the hero, him or her, as a talisman of fertility. We are obvious because by metonymy, the radiation of fertility and blessedness comes to the whole community. This is fundamental to ancient Greek religion. It survives, okay, maybe not directly, but indirectly in modern Greek religion or in modern Greek local religious practices. And there it is. Glenn, I'm not going to do the other one. Because what I really want to emphasize now is, if we flip back again to the first side, side A, one, do you remember when Tiresias says, I'm going to give you a hint? And we, who are now tuned in readers, we know that this word, sema, means not just a token, a hint, a sign, a signal. What else does it mean? It means the tomb of a hero. And remember, I always say the hero is dynamic. You can't pin the hero down. You can pin the hero down only at the moment of his death. And the symbol of that moment where you can finally pin down his meaning is his tomb, his sema, as we saw in the slide lecture, with that beautiful whiteness that radiates out towards us and hits us, so to speak, between the eyes. It is this tomb which means the death of a hero, and when everything comes together, and when his charisma or her charisma as a talisman of fertility can start, that thing is the same thing as the word for meaning. And I think it says a great deal about ancient Greek song culture that the very idea of meaning, of semantics, all goes back to this one focal point, this one crisis point, which is the tomb of the hero. I'd like to leave you with an image, okay? And the image is this. Can you imagine what it's like to make a sacrifice to Poseidon, your divine antagonist, and place an oar with the blade of the oar pointing upwards into the ground? What would that look like? Well, very interestingly, it depends on whether you're thinking of this as an oar or a winnowing shovel. And I'm telling you, in terms of material culture, they look exactly the same. They're exactly the same. Okay? So, can you see a sort of oar sticking out of a mound? Let me tell you something that we know from ancient Greek history. This is a real tradition of harvesters, which is after the harvester has finally winnowed all the grain, separating the real thing from the chaff. And there's a mound. You know what the harvester does? The harvester plants the ore on top. Okay? And so again, you see the same thing if you see it from far away in a profile, is an ore sticking out of a mass of richness, a mass of fertility, which is the grain that has been harvested. So that means that if you're looking at this profile, it really means two things. The two things are, number one, the hero is dead. And number two, the harvest is finished, and it's time to celebrate. It's time for a festival. Even more beautiful, do you remember that loutish young sailor who dies, and then his spirit haunts Odysseus, and he wants to be buried? He says, give me the typical burial of a sailor. Well, guess what that is? That is, again, a mound and an oar sticking out of it. So now I can give you sort of three definitions. Number one, if you look at this picture of what Odysseus has planted when he plants his oar, it's either the sailor is dead, or, if you like, the hero's cult is beginning, or the harvest is done and the celebration should begin. I'm suggesting that all of these meanings come together in this beautiful inos, which is not only an audio inos, it's also a video thema, because it is a picture of the tomb of the hero beyond the Odyssey, beyond the narrative, at a point where we can finally see the hero, not as in motion, but finally at rest, finally giving charisma and happiness to the whole community. So I can hardly wait to see you next week and